to get me to cross this stage today. I never want the focus to be Amazima. I never want the focus to be me. Because parents are parents, and you know, I'm a mom. I have my own children, and it is my joy to be able to care for and provide them. And if for some reason I couldn't.
Well, Katie, one last question. What does Amazima look like as you think about the future of the organization, looking out at the next 5 to 10 years? And as you guys continue to shift and change and innovate, like at this point in the organization, you guys are, like I said earlier, there's a lot of programming going on. There's
less than 10 American staff on the ground and about 290 Ugandan staff. And so that is super important to us. We want our students to always be able to look at our leadership and see people who look like them. And we want them to know that they can be leaders. We hope that they will graduate from our programming and become leaders in Amazima.
So that has that idea of creating opportunities where kids can stay with their family in their homes and the ministry is providing the funds for them to be able to go to school. Has that model continued and retained? Welcome back to the Ministry Growth Show. Today on the show, I'm excited to speak with Katie Davis Majors. She is the executive director and founder of Amazima Ministries. Katie, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
How'd I do with that pronunciation?
You said it right.
Corrected on that?
All right, no, cool. It's a hard one. Amazima.
Amazima. Awesome. Can you share a little bit about the origin story, how you guys got started? I know your story is very intertwined with that origin story. Oh.
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually had gone on a short-term missions trip to Uganda my senior year of high school with my mom and had been interested in missions, but not really anything long-term. And just while I was there, I was really captivated by Uganda, the place, the people, the hospitality, the warmth, the kindness, and had a Ugandan pastor say to me, "I foresee that you're going to come back here. And when God brings you back here, my wife and I would love to offer you a place to stay. We'd love to have you work alongside us." They had an orphanage that was pretty rural. It was different than the place I was originally volunteering on that trip. Mm-hmm. And so I went with him to visit his orphanage, and I saw poverty like I had never seen or experienced before. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I just kind of stored it away. I came back, I finished high school, but the closer and closer I got to graduation, the more and more I started to entertain this idea of a gap year. What if I did go to Uganda for a year and serve alongside this pastor and his wife? And so that's how I started out. I went to Uganda when I was 18. I had just graduated high school. And, you know, my parents and I had agreed that it was a gap year and it was only a year. And I would come back to the United States and kind of get back on the more typical college, job, mm-hmm. marriage, you know, track that they had set for me. Of course, that didn't happen. I got to Uganda and I worked alongside that pastor and his wife. They were unbelievably kind and generous to let me stay with them. And I feel really thankful that I just kind of got this full cultural immersion experience straight off the bat and was working with them and the kids that they served. And where we lived, the orphanage was kind of the only type of charitable organization that was around. It was kind of a hub for all the things. And there weren't that many staff. There was not that much help. There wasn't often enough food. There wasn't often enough medication. When children got sick, it was pretty underfunded. And my heart just broke for these kids and what they were experiencing. The longer I lived there, you know, I developed friendship with these children. They ranged anywhere in age from 2 to 18. And so the older kids would sit and tell me their stories and tell me about their lives. And a lot of them would talk about their parents and grandparents and family members. They would go visit on the weekends. They would go visit family members. And so that was really surprising to me. I think as an American, my kind of only context for an orphanage was I thought that meant that your parents had died, or maybe they did not want relationship with you, and so they had sent mm-hmm. you away. And as I began asking more questions, I realized that in East Africa, that's not usually the narrative. A lot of times kids are sent to orphanages or other type of group homes or institutional care simply because of poverty. Their parents do love them. They do care for them. They do want them to have a bright future. And they see, you know, if there's only one kind of place of charitable aid in a community, that's kind of your only option. And so in Uganda, school is really expensive for families. It's really hard to afford tuition for your child to go to school. And then that compounds if you have multiple children, especially if you're working. Most of our friends in Uganda are working as farmers. And so they're just eating what they grow, and that's kind of how they live. And so a lot of people were sending their kids to live in institutional care simply because they wanted them to have access to education. And so, I mean, long story short, that didn't sit well with me. And I thought, wow, if these kids had the opportunity to be raised by their parents in their home community, and all they need is the equivalent of a couple hundred dollars a year to go to school, like that seems like a pretty simple fix. And I come from a pretty affluent community in the United States where we're spending, you know, a couple hundred dollars, maybe if you go out to eat to a really nice meal. And so I called my mom and I said, hey, guess what's happening here? I had become friends with a grandmother, and she was raising her 5-year-old twin granddaughters. And so they were getting to the age where they were about to go, they were going to need to go to kindergarten. And she was considering sending them to live at the orphanage so that they would be assigned a sponsor, and then they would get to go to school. And so I sat with her over lunch one day and just said, hey, what if I found them a sponsor and was able to get you guys the money to send them to school and help you with some stuff around the house, food, medicine when they need it? Would you be willing to keep them at home with you? And this sweet grandmother, she started crying, and she said, I mean, absolutely. I want to raise my grandkids. I want them to have access to a brighter future than I can give them. So I called my mom and was like, hey, you know, I need $50. We got to help these kids. This is what we're going to do. And my parents are super supportive. They were all in. They started telling their friends and colleagues and just different people in my home community about what was going on. I was keeping a blog at the time that I was writing stories just of my day-to-day life for people who had given me a little money to sustain me on my gap year. Did not expect that blog would be read by people all over the world, but people started hearing the stories and sending money to help. And so I started sending these two little girls to school, and then their grandmother introduced me to other people in the community who had similar needs. And before I knew it, I was sending 10 kids to school and then 40 kids to school. So after I'd been in Uganda for about a year, I was collecting money and then sending 40 children in our community in Uganda to school. And my dad said, hey, you know, you should probably like register as a nonprofit or something, so you're not just perpetually raising money and doling out money in a different place. And so really prayed about what God would have me, you know, you had to have a name to file the paperwork. Prayed about what God would have me call it. And truth was something that kept coming to mind. In John 8:32, it says, you shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And just, I felt it really impressed on me that I didn't want these friends and this community to just have access to education and medical care and food, though those are all good and necessary things. But I wanted them to really know the truth of the gospel and know that God created them with value and in his image, and to know him and to walk deeply with him. And so Amazima is the Luganda word for truth. And that's where the name Amazima came from. I also decided around that time that I was not going to come back to the United States and do the kind of traditional path. I did come back and do college for a semester, but I was just still trying to manage things overseas, and my heart just desperately wanted to be back there. So moved to Uganda, spent the next 15 years living in Uganda, and Amazima just organically grew and grew. I mean, I look back now and it is really it's astounding to me, like just God's hand and the way that he brought the right people alongside me, brought the right staff alongside me, continued to sustain donations and our financial needs. And the more that we had, you know, as we had more finances, we just sponsored more and more kids. So discipleship is a really important part of our organization. As a teenager, I had a woman who was about my mom's age through Young Life just kind of seek me out and invest in me. And watching her love Jesus was such a catalyst for my own relationship with Jesus. And so I want all the kids in our program to have access to that. And so a lot of our programming today is really built around intentional small group or one-on-one discipleship. We've grown to have almost 700 students in our program. And then, you know, we reach out through our students to their families and communities and have a lot of family strengthening and community strengthening programs. Coming out of that, we have a primary school and a secondary school. So ranging from like grade one all the way through what in Uganda is S6. So like year 13. So yeah, growing, thriving, flourishing beyond my wildest imagination.
Awesome. You mentioned early on about the orphanage or the orphan situation with the pastors that you stayed with. That they ran the orphanage differently than what you'd seen elsewhere. Can you dive into that a little bit?
I don't know that they necessarily ran it differently than I had seen elsewhere, so much as it was just in a much more impoverished location than the first place we originally had visited. And I think I had any limited exposure I had had to the word orphan had caused me to think that an orphanage was a place where children only went
just
to live
didn't have parents.
Something. Yeah, if they didn't have parents. And so this is an old statistic from several years ago, but several years ago, the statistic was that 85% of children living in institutional care in East Africa actually have at least one living parent. And that's, I mean, in my 15 years in Uganda, I saw that to be true, that often children are living in these institutions, not because of the absence of a loving family, but because of poverty. Now, the Ugandan government and surrounding governments are doing a really good job pushing for a lot more foster care, home family type situations. And so orphanages are starting to kind of slowly phase out. I feel like orphan care has grown leaps and bounds in the last 20 years. And so there's been a lot more education. And I think people are kind of starting to take notice of what is working and what isn't working and changing things a bit. So the landscape's pretty different than when I started almost 20 years ago, which is a good thing.
So that has the idea of creating opportunities where kids can stay with their family in their homes and the ministry is providing the funds for them to be able to go to school. Has that model continued and retained as the organization has progressed? Has that then continued to be the focus that we want to keep these kids with their families?
Yes, absolutely. And so everything that we do is family focused and family centered. We have a primary school that's like grade 1 through 7, and the children just come from the communities during the day and we send them home. We also have a team of social workers that does things with the parents and guardians while the children are at school during the day. At the secondary level, we do have students who board and live on our campus, but we have parental involvement days throughout the year where parents come and are on campus with them, worshiping with them, visiting them. And then, you know, they have long holidays from school where they're back with their families as well. But I always say that my goal is that when a child graduates from our secondary school, that their graduation speech is, look what my parents did and look how much my parents sacrificed to get me to cross this stage today. I never want the focus to be Amazima. I never want the focus to be me, because parents are parents. And, you know, I'm a mom. I have my own children and it is my joy to be able to care for and provide them. And if for some reason I couldn't, I would want someone to come alongside me and help me, but I wouldn't want someone to swoop in and take over that responsibility. So as much as we can, we try to undergird the parents and uplift and empower them so that they can provide for their own children.
Yeah. How do you guys continue to innovate around that idea where we're creating models and strategies and opportunities that retain the dignity of the parents and position them as the ones that are supporting their kids while yet the organization still exists? Like, you guys still are providing charity and aid. Like, what does that innovation look like to continue to push for that, I guess, a long-term sustainable model?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's something that's always changing and that we're always like, you know, trying to learn more and more about, especially the question of sustainability. We have a team of 300 staff in Uganda, and they are phenomenal. And we've got a ton of social workers on our team that spend a lot of time in the community and with these parents. I think relational equity is really, really important. And that's why we have such a large staff, because we want every family that's in our program, every student that's in our program, to be really, truly and deeply known. I don't ever want anybody to be a number on a spreadsheet. I want everybody to have a staff member at Amazima. Of course, it's not going to be me. We're way too big for that. But I hope that every child in our program has a staff member who knows their name, all their siblings' names, their parents' names, where they live, can walk to their house. And we've seen that. Our staff have been incredible. We had to shut pretty much all programming. Schools closed for almost 2 full years during COVID. It was the longest school closures in the world in Uganda. And we, you weren't allowed to drive a car, but you were allowed to drive a motorcycle. And so we bought motorcycles, and we taught our staff how to drive them. And our staff went to our students' homes and maintained their social distance, but checked on them in their homes and brought their schoolwork to their homes. And so we have a large team of people who know these kids really intimately. And I think that's really important, because then we can't, you know, if we don't know organizationally how to do something, we can go to our staff and ask, how would it be best done for this specific family in this specific scenario? I think another thing that we've learned kind of in some ways the hard way over the years is that sometimes giving people everything is actually not a win when it comes to empowerment. And so, you know, when we first started Amazima, we gave people everything. We paid for all the school fees and all the supplies that you needed to go to school, and all the food and all the transportation, everything, because to me that was generosity. I feel like I had access to more and I would give people more, and that just seemed like the logical thing to do. What we've seen over the years is buy-in is actually super important. And so even people who have a little often want to participate, especially when it comes to providing for their children. And so we do different things in different situations, but a lot of times we ask parents to pay for school supplies and we'll cover the school fees, which is the larger cost. We had a situation, and we have learned this by trial and error. This is by no means perfect, but years and years ago, we were providing everything for the students. And then we kind of sat back and reevaluated and had this moment of like, actually, to have the parent buy-in, we need to have parents start participating a little bit more. And we had a scenario where the student showed up. We had agreed that the parents were going to provide the school supplies that are needed to come to school. And it's minimal. It's like some pencils and some paper and an eraser. We do the big stuff. But we had a student show up without her supplies, and her mother was there. And I made the decision that we had to send the student home until she could bring her supplies. And my staff were like mad at me. They were like, what are you doing? And it is on paper, it's like 3 pencils, you know, like it's probably the equivalent of 50 cents. I could get the 3 pencils and hand them to the kid and have her go to school. But what happened is the mom went home and she had a large flock of chickens, and she went that day and sold her chicken and bought her daughter the supplies she needed and brought her back to school. And we talk about that often as a team because of that same idea I shared earlier, that now when this student graduates from high school, she's going to be able to say, I watched my mom sacrifice for me to be here, versus saying, oh, I owe it to these Americans, or I owe it to this person, I owe it to this organization that I'm here. And I think the idea that she will have that cemented in her, that she will honor her mom for the sacrifice her mom made to get her there, is really important. And so it's case by case. We truly do have families in our program where they would not be able to provide the supplies. And so in some, we have like whole spreadsheets and different, you know, data to show that in some situations we do need to intervene, but we try to ask the parents to contribute when they can. We really try to use language like, this is a community school for the community. This is your school. We have parents that come and volunteer at school. We have a PTA, you know, lots of things to try to get the parents to buy in. We ask for their opinions a lot. And then we do community strengthening programs where we are, you know, doing savings and loans groups and helping them learn how to financially plan. And I think at first people were afraid of that because they were afraid that if they were financially doing better, then we wouldn't provide for the schooling anymore. So we've tried to encourage them like, no, this is for you and for your future, but we're still going to be here. We're not going anywhere. But there's a lot of trial and error. I don't think we have it perfectly by any means, but I think making sure that our policies work for people as opposed to the other way around and just writing up policies and then all having to blindly follow them has been, it's harder that way, but I think we've seen some progress.
Well, it sounds like there's a big organizational push towards national partnership and supporting locals in the work that you guys do. What's the percentage of individuals working for the organization or alongside the organization that are national versus your maybe headquarters team?
Yeah. Percentage is not something I can tell you off the top of my head, but overall we have probably less than 10 American staff on the ground and about 290 Ugandan staff. And so that is super important to us. We want our students to always be able to look at our leadership and see people who look like them. And we want them to know that they can be leaders. We hope that they will graduate from our programming and become leaders in Amazima. That's the dream. That would be amazing. They're incredible individuals, but we want them, certainly we want them to look at our leadership and see people who have a similar story to them and know that their story and their life situation doesn't disqualify them for leadership. And then we have a very small team here in the United States that's just really doing development and fundraising and management from this side.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
But our leadership team on the ground in Uganda currently probably has 2 Americans and 8 Ugandans on it. So it's pretty, percentage-wise, the leadership organization is at least 80% Ugandan, if not more. And that's, I hope that percentage only grows.
Yeah, something to be proud of. So what makes Amazima different from other aid organizations? Maybe specifically working in Uganda, is there unique differentiators or distinct approaches that you guys follow that makes you guys unique?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one thing that really sets us apart is the relational aspect of it. We're really selective about our staff. We really hand pick our staff because we want, you know, it doesn't matter if you are a groundskeeper or a cook or a classroom teacher or a mentor or a social worker. We want you to have a really strong personal relationship with Jesus that you can model in front of our students and in front of the community. I think in living in Uganda for over a decade, I have seen all the money poured in and all the buildings built. And I really truly believe that no amount of programming or buildings or money is really going to result in long-term life change. I think only a relationship does that. And I have only seen lives truly transformed in relationship. And so I think that our students know that they're not a number. I think they know that, you know, this is not just a sponsorship program where we get you through the end of the program. And when you turn 18, you're done. We stay with our students all the way through college. We hope to maintain relationship with them long after college. We see that our staff members become almost like family to our students and their family members. I mean, we even have staff members who have left our staff for various reasons or gone on to other jobs. They no longer work for Amazima, but if there is a birthday party or a birth or a funeral for a family that they worked with, you know you're going to see them at that event because they have stayed connected to the family. So I think our we call our social workers mentors because that's really, we want them to be so much more than social workers. We want them to be disciplers of the students that they work with. And I think that that is something that really sets us apart. And I think that children and teenagers and young adults, I mean, people just in general, like we thrive when we feel safe. We thrive when we feel seen and when we feel known. And so that's our hope for the people that we work with is that, the Amazima staff and the Amazima campus is a place of real safety for them. And I think that, you know, lives can only change and transform and grow when there is safety there. And so I hope that that's something that we are providing. It's certainly something that we are always actively working for. We also pour a lot of resources into our staff because, again, how can our staff be making disciples and coming alongside people and helping them feel safe and seen and known and loved unless they have that themselves. And so we have a large program where we're doing small group Bible studies with our staff and making sure that they are really well taken care of because they see a lot of really hard stuff and they have to walk with people through a lot of really hard stuff. I mean, that's the flip side, right? If you're going to be in intentional relationship, there's going to be a lot of celebration and you're carrying a lot because you're walking with people in suffering. And so we try really hard and have a pretty significant budget for making sure our staff are really well resourced and have access to counseling and have access to just a lot of care for themselves. And that's something that we are really actively even trying to improve going forward because burnout is such a real thing. And it is so hard to be as intentional as we want to be and walk with people in their suffering. And so we want our staff to be well equipped to do that. We also want them to be able to rest when they need to rest.
Yeah, that relational aspect seems to be such a strong distinctive for you guys. And it ties in, and you've mentioned this multiple times, but the discipleship approach or discipleship is such an integral part to what you guys are doing. Can you talk about discipleship and what that actually looks like tangibly for the organization and within the organization?
Yeah. So when we first started, I mean, we were very small and there were only, you know, like I said, we went from like 10 to 40 kids in about a year and a half. And during that time, I was just having the kids come over to my house once or twice a week after school. And we were doing Bible studies and I was visiting the kids in their homes. I was visiting with their parents, asking them like, hey, what do you know about Jesus? Are you connected to a local church? And so just started really organically in that way. And then as we grew, realized, oh, if I want these kids to have an individual relationship with someone, I'm not going to be able to do that. You can only know so many people. And so started kind of handpicking other believing staff members to come alongside me and be mentors. And for a while, we were sponsoring children to go to a lot of different schools, just kind of based on where they were located, schools that already existed in their community. And a lot of the schools were really great to let the Amazima staff come during lunchtime and do Bible studies with the students, both, you know, both the Amazima students and other students would always come in and sit and listen in. And so that was a lot of fun. Now we also have our own school campuses. And so we're able to teach. We teach the Ugandan national curriculum. We don't want to be an international school. We want to be a Ugandan school. But we're able to teach that curriculum and teach our teachers how to instruct from a biblical worldview and just like integrate biblical teaching throughout the lessons. So a lot of just their daily classroom lessons are taught in that way. And we encourage a lot of question asking, which I think is really, really huge for kids as they develop in the primary. Like for the younger kids, they're all assigned a mentor that will check up on them in their home and have small group meetings with them at school and check in on them one-on-one as needed. In our secondary section, our students live on campus, and so they're assigned what we call a family mentor. And basically, we have anywhere between 12 and 20 students living in these dorms that are kind of, you know, they're 4 to 6 to a room, kind of college style, but they all are paired with a married couple that is their family mentors for the duration of their time in our school. And that's so that they have a model of a healthy marriage to look at. They see what a Christian marriage looks like, and they have kind of a mom and dad figure. We intentionally don't use the word house parents because, again, we don't want to replace the parents. We love the parents. We're here to support the parents. So that's why we use the language family mentor. But the idea is that they have a kind of mom and dad figure on campus for them to go to. And they are, you know, they're waking up every morning and doing a devotional together with their house. They're going off to school, and then they're coming home essentially to a Christian couple who is walking with them through all the various things that happen in the high school day that need love and nurturing and advice. And then we have a whole student life department, which does kind of things like small groups on Wednesday nights that they're a part of. And they do, you know, obviously they do like a Sunday morning worship. And so there are lots of different opportunities, but it's fun because one of my favorite times of the year is we'll do once or twice a year, we'll do baptisms for anybody who wants that. And we'll ask the students to share a little bit about how their faith has deepened and why they've made the decision to be baptized. And they almost always cite a staff member. And sometimes it's a family mentor or someone that you would expect, but sometimes it really is just like, oh, the librarian started helping me study and then asked me if I wanted to take a walk with her every day after class and then started sharing with me about Jesus. And so, yeah, we try to weave it into everything that we're doing and think that, you know, discipleship doesn't have to be done at a devotional or in a small group. For me, it was done on walks and sitting on the couch eating cookies, you know, just these everyday opportunities to point people to Jesus.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Well, you guys have a lot going on. You got discipleship programs, or at least an idea of what that looks like. You have an operational school or schools, vocational training programs, medical services. Like, how do you avoid, we'll just say, mission drift when there are so many things that you offer as an organization?
That's a great question. We certainly have to reevaluate a lot, I think, and especially in the context of our community in Uganda, there is a lot of need. And so mission drift is just extremely possible, right? Because you want to meet all the needs that you encounter. Thankfully, in the area we're in, there have sprung up kind of a lot more organizations. And so we lean heavily on partnership. We really try to know the landscape of like who else is out there doing similar work. You know, we do cover some medical care for the students that are in our program, obviously, but you know, if somebody needed an extensive surgery or there was an emergency with a family member, you know, we try to kind of have a good grasp on, is there another organization that could do this that's doing only this and therefore would do it better than us? So I think that is something that is helpful, is just knowing the landscape and knowing what other services are available that we can point people to, that we can connect people to. We have a lot of partnerships in the area as far as that goes, but we spend a lot of time as a leadership team, just like constantly reevaluating where do we want to go? And on, are, you know, are we on that track? Because it does, it starts to happen, right? You give a little here and then years later, mm-hmm. you find you're in a place that you didn't want to be. So I think just a lot of reevaluation is really key.
Yeah. Well, like you said, there's so much need. It can be easy to chase the need and find yourself running a clean water organization when you started out doing right. what you're doing, right? And so yeah. it's
thankfully
always
there
interesting.
Are a lot of those.
yeah. right,
but I do
right.
think, I mean, I do think looking around and seeing, you know, I think that's great advice for any ministry leader is looking around and seeing, okay, who else is in this space and who's mm-hmm. doing. Who's doing this better than me? Who's doing this differently than me? Like, who else is doing this? Well, if we did need clean water, like, who is a clean water organization that's right. reputable and doing it well? And can we give them a call? I think it can be funny to me. I think both in the missions space and the church space, there can almost be some like territorialism of like, well, I'm doing this part of town and you're doing that part of town. And that just makes me laugh and maybe cry. But because, you know, to kind of pull back and go, oh, our end goal here is the same. Like mm-hmm. We're all shooting for the same thing. We want God to be glorified. And so trying to join forces with as many organizations as possible rather than kind of live in that spirit of competition has been really important to us.
That's good. Well, hey, I want to take a moment to hear from today's sponsor. But when we come back, I'd love to get into the idea of letting others lead well. And get your thoughts on that. Hey, ministry leaders. Today's episode is sponsored by Click Nonprofit. Are you looking to grow your ministry but don't have the money or marketing knowledge to make that happen? There's good news. Google offers an advertising grant to churches and ministries that is worth $10,000 per month. This means that if your ministry is a 501c3 nonprofit, you are eligible to receive $120,000 per year in free advertising dollars. This allows you to place ads at the top of Google search results page and drive thousands of visitors to your ministry website every month. Our sponsor, Click Nonprofit, helps your ministry acquire this Google ad grant and then manages your Google ads to ensure you get the most out of the grant. Schedule a free consultation at clicknonprofit.com to learn more about how this grant can help your specific ministry. Mention the Ministry Growth Show when you sign up and get 20% off your first 3 months of management. Hey, welcome back to the Ministry Growth Show. We've been talking with Katie Davis Majors. She's the founder of Amazima Ministries. Katie, as we get back into the conversation, you mentioned before the call and the recording this idea of letting other people lead. As you've grown the organization, as the organization has gotten bigger, what does that look like for you guys as a leadership team? What does that look like in your partnerships with nationals and locals that you're working with and coming alongside? Talk to me about this idea of letting other people lead.
Yeah, I mean, it's an idea that I feel really passionate about that I just kind of stumbled into. It's not really my own wisdom, but as Amazima continued to grow, it rapidly outgrew me and my capability and even my expertise. Also, as Amazima continued to grow, I started fostering my first children. And so I was kind of becoming a mother and trying to run this massively growing organization out of my home. And I feel like in looking back, I see that that was just God's grace to me, that he really did give me, he gave me more than I could hold, you know, and he gave me more than I could do on my own. And it forced me to need help. And so God brought a couple people who were really, really different than me into my life early on in Amazima. I had a few coworkers that were just good at the things that I was not good at and detail oriented in a way that I was not. And sometimes that caused tension, but a lot of times, I mean, I look back and I think like the only way that Amazima grew in the way that it did was because there were people who didn't think like me and didn't do things like me that were mm-hmm. alongside me. And I think I could, knowing my personality, I could have been really territorial about that, but I was so busy that I didn't have time to worry about that. And I mean, I think that was God's kindness. And because I got to experience that really early on, that became kind of a core value of being able to look at other people and identify the skill sets that they had that I might not have, or ask myself, like, what is he better at doing than I am? And how can I encourage that? And that can feel really, really scary as a ministry leader, because they might do the task you've given them to do really well and the way that you would like it done, or they might not. And I mean, there have been times where I have let people lead and it has not gone well, and we have had to step back and reevaluate. But more often than not, there have been times where I have let other people lead in an area, or I've delegated an area, and they have maybe not done it exactly the way that I would have done it, but things have grown and flourished and been really good because of that. And so I think that has, the more and more I have practiced that, the more and more I've been able to have a more open-handed posture. And I think, you know, it goes back to kind of trusting, like, okay, Lord, like, if I really do trust you, and I really do, I mean, I say all the time, people ask me, oh, is this what you envisioned Amazima would look like? And I'm like, no, I was like 20. I didn't envision anything. Yeah. I was just kind of trying to make sure that my neighbors had what they needed, and had access to school. You know, I had no grand plans. And so if I can say that, and I can say that I truly believe that the way we have grown is just all by God's grace and his hand and his intention, then I should be able to look at people on my staff and say, like, okay, by God's grace and his intention, he has brought you here. And if I really, really trust that you are walking in step with him, I can trust that you can take this part of ministry and run with it, and we will stay in communication, and I will be here to help you if you mess it up. And I say that to staff all the time. I hope that if you mess up, I am your first call. And it's not, oh, I'm embarrassed because I feel like I've messed this up. No, I have messed up so many more times than I would ever care to admit. And so, you know, if things aren't going well, come and, like, let's talk about it and let's figure it out. And I think in leading from that posture, that's been really hard for me, because, you know, you really are, like, sitting over on the side, like, oh my gosh, please don't mess up. But God's been able to grow it so much more than I ever could have on my own. And had I tried to keep everything, if I had tried to control everything and keep it to where I could understand everything and everything was done exactly the way that I wanted it to go, like, there just isn't opportunity for growth in that. And so I see it a lot in founders, and sometimes even in, like, pastors that have started their own kind of church. And it's easy to feel the weight of that responsibility, right? And so you feel like, well, it's up to me to make sure that everything's done really well, because at the end of the day, it's my name on this thing, and I'm the person who's responsible, and it's my reputation that's tied really closely with this organization. And I deeply understand that. But I think then you find people that are smarter than you, and you find people that are more creative than you, and you talk a lot, and you meet together a lot, and you learn to care about each other a lot, and you fail together a lot. But I think I've also seen that people, if people can't kind of take their ideas and own in their space and run with it, they kind of start to shrink under leadership like that. And then you don't get the best of them, right? And so I think giving people some freedom to lead in their areas really brings out the best of their creativity and their own leadership. And so, it's a work in progress for me. There are still days where I'm like, oh, no, don't do it that way. But trying to trust that, like, God is at work, and he's at work in the people that he's put around me to lead as well.
Well, and it becomes a discipleship opportunity for you and the leaders within the organization, just as much as it is with the organizational leaders and the children that you're supporting and coming alongside. How you mentioned earlier, you guys have a big emphasis on caring for your leaders and making sure that we're doing everything that we can to avoid burnout, which is so prevalent in the ministry space. How does this idea of coming alongside leaders and giving freedom correspond and maybe cross paths with, what does leadership development look like alongside the spiritual health of your leaders?
Yeah, I mean, I think one example that's coming to mind is we hired a new CEO about a year ago.
Okay.
Anyway, and she and I meet together pretty often, and we just met a couple weeks ago, and we talked the entire time about stuff that was going on in her personal life and how she was doing and how her kids were doing and how marriage was. And at the end of our time together, she said, "Oh, I didn't give you the ministry update. Like, we didn't talk about that." And I was like, "No, that's great. That's not what I wanted. I want to know how you are doing. And I hope that when you are managing your staff, like, that you want to know how they are doing." And so I think a lot of it is just like having people, I think if we can create the culture that lets people know that they are people before they are jobs, I don't ever want any of our staff to feel like it's just about a job. It really, truly is about how they are doing as people. And all of that is going to spill over into how they're doing at work and how they lead. And so, I feel like I love my role now because I just get to be everybody's friend and know how they're doing and see how I can encourage them and how I can uplift them and making sure that they are healthy and connected to resources, whether that's connected to a local church where they're being poured into or connected to different counseling resources where they're able to process what they're seeing. I love being able to kind of help make sure that our staff are really well resourced and that they are being well led both inside our organization and outside our organization, because as they continue to flourish, that's how our organization is going to continue to flourish.
You've mentioned a handful of times, or at least used terminology that, like this idea of being known, knowing and being known, a lot of spiritual formation movement type language. Like, how much of your leadership development, discipleship, and spiritual formation, how much of that stuff within the organization is influenced by that spiritual formation movement? The guys like Dallas Willard and Kurt Thompson, and like, do those names ring a bell and influence how you guys think about this stuff?
The names ring a bell. I read a lot. so the names ring a bell. And it is language that I really resonate with. I think we're using all different resources. We read books together as a team. But I do think spiritual formation is really important. And so those are different things that we're trying to incorporate into different staff retreats and different group meetings as possible.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. That's awesome. Well, Katie, one last question. What does Amazima look like as you think about the future of the organization, looking out at the next 5 to 10 years? And as you guys continue to shift and change and innovate, like at this point in the organization, you guys are, like I said earlier, there's a lot of programming going on. You got a lot of hands in different aspects of ministry. We talked about the whole mission drift thing, but how do you classify the organization? Are you guys poverty alleviation now? Are you development? Like, what categories are you falling into? Because it's not just orphan care anymore. There's so many things that you guys are doing. And as you continue to look into the future, how does that kind of impact and drive the decisions that you're making?
Yeah, the language we come back to a lot when we talk about mission is discipleship through education. And so discipleship is the goal of our organization. Education is the vehicle that we've found to be effective because it's a large quantity of time with our students, mm-hmm. and it's a vehicle to get to their families and their communities. We're finally at the stage in the game where we are graduating kids from high school and sending them on to college and watching them even go on to their first jobs and come back to their communities to invest in their communities. We've got multiple staff members now at Amazima. We've got teachers and mentors and even teacher assistants who were once Amazima children, and they are excited to be back and investing in their communities. And so that's super exciting. We just had our high school graduates. They have a big break. The school year is different in Uganda, and they have a big break between high school and college. And so they have internships all around our community at coffee shops, at the dental office, at the hospital. There are lots of Amazima students in all these different internship spaces. And it's just really, really cool to see them like out in the world doing their adult thing and pouring back into their place and their spaces. As we look toward the future, we're kind of asking the question, you know, we've talked about discipling our students. We've talked about discipling even our staff. We're kind of looking towards the future and going, how do we come alongside and in essence kind of disciple other like-minded organizations? And so as we look at the landscape of Uganda and East Africa, there isn't really a need for another school building, and there isn't really a need for another nonprofit. And so we're kind of going, okay, we're at a stage in the game where we're pretty well versed in what we're doing, and we could replicate and build schools all over the country. We don't want to do that because there are other like-minded people in other parts of the country that are already doing the work and already have the relational equity. And again, I think that that's the most important part. Mm. You get to deeply know a community by doing life there and by relating with people and eating in their homes and walking to church together. And so we've identified some other organizations around the country, or just some individuals around the country, that have started schools and are already deeply invested in their community, but are really having a hard time getting the funding and the resources that we need. And so our next big move over the next 5 to 10 years is just to identify these other like-minded partners and say, okay, how can we come alongside you as a big brother or a big sister and share our resources, share our curriculum, share our staff training, share the things that we're doing that we think are working. Also, we can share with you all the things we've done wrong that you should avoid that are not working, and kind of help come alongside and resource other like-minded organizations. Because again, like, my heart is not about competition. We want to see, like, how can we lock arms with other people who are on the same mission, who might just need a little bit of a boost and an encouragement along the way. So it feels like a really, really exciting time. Uganda is a really, like, rapidly growing and developing nation. And so it's just it feels like an exciting time to be on the front end of education through discipleship and how to get that into different parts of the country.
Mm, that's awesome. Well, Katie, this has been a really fun conversation. If people want to get a hold of you, learn more about what you guys are doing, maybe they'll want to come alongside and partner with you guys, how can they do so?
Yeah, so we're online. I'm on Instagram and have a website, katiedavismajors.com. And then Amazima also has a website, amazima.org. That's A-M-A-Z-I-M-A. Kind of a hard one to remember, but we share each other's stuff all the time. So if they want to find us online, there are all kinds of opportunities on our website for how to get involved and how to give and how to stay updated.
Awesome. I'll be sure to put those in the show notes. Can I pray for you as we wrap up?
Yeah, I'd love it.
Awesome. Father, thank you so much for this conversation with Katie, and just lift up Amazima Ministries and all that you are doing through this organization and through Katie and her leadership team. I pray that you would just continue to go before them, guide and lead and direct their paths, and continue to bless kids going through the program and through the ministry, and bless their discipleship efforts and organization, leadership, health, and leadership development. Lord, we just lift these things up to you, and thank you for your invitation for us to partner with you in this redemptive work and redemptive story. Lord, you could have done it on your own, and you chose to partner with us. And we just thank you for that and love you for that. And we ask these things in your precious name, Jesus. Amen. Okay. Katie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Yeah, this was fun.
Awesome. We'll see you later.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ministry Growth Show. If you've enjoyed it, we'd appreciate it if you rate and review us on your favorite podcasting app, and make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. If you have a story or expertise to share with other ministry directors and pastors, or know someone who would be a great guest for the show, let us know. We love connecting with ministry executives and sharing their wisdom and insight with our audience. Just send us an email at podcast@reliantcreative.org. And lastly, if you need help telling your ministry's story, we would love to share how we can help in that process. Check out Reliant Creative at reliantcreative.org and book a call today. See you next time.